60th anniversary celebration events. This is the 60th anniversary of the Hong Kong, of the move of the FCC from Chongqing to Hong Kong. But nevertheless, some of our events have been more, if you like, general, but some are very specific to the core interests of the club, and this obviously is one of those. This is a discussion about where we are in the media business and where we're going. Very briefly, just before we get to that, let me just remind you that there is a lunch tomorrow with Jasper Becker. There are still some places available. That's about ancient Beijing. We have a anniversary celebration cocktails event on June the 19th. And on the 15th, we have the chief executive, Donald Jung, coming. Obviously, there's going to be very big demand for that event. The sign-ups, I think, are going to start tomorrow. So if you're at all interested in coming to that, I do recommend you pop in very quickly. Let me, before we go any further, just introduce the three speakers we have today. Very fortunate to have an extremely good lineup today. Casey Chan is the chief editor of the Hong Kong Economic Journal. Like so many newspapers these days, under new ownership now. Not strictly of a media company, but we'll no doubt get to that. Eric Wishart is in the wholesaling business of news agencies. He's the Asia Pacific director of Agence France-Presse. And Browning on my left, but I'm sure not politically, is a former editor of, I don't know, is a former editor of the Far East Economic Review. He's a columnist for the International Herald Tribune, and he's also involved in new media, and we'll definitely get to that as this discussion proceeds. What we're going to do is have the beginning of this session will be a discussion between the panelists, and then we'll open it up to the floor and obviously invite everybody to join in. And what I'd like to do is put to all three panelists the two, if you like, big scenarios that are being presented for the media these days. One is, it's a disaster. People aren't going to be reading newspapers. They aren't going to watch the usual terrestrial television stations or listen to the usual radio stations. New media is the future. Time for everybody to get up. Newspapers and magazines are definitely closing. Jobs in the media, something close to many of our hearts, are being lost like a deluge, and the future looks very bleak indeed. There is an alternative scenario that comes from the World Association of Newspapers, which you may say has a vested interest in presenting it, but let me present it to you. They point out that the global circulation of newspapers last year is up 1.3%, and that 1.9 billion people per day read a newspaper, and that of the people, of the adults who use the web, let's note the word adults as opposed to younger people, 60% read newspapers as opposed to 40% who regularly use the web. So the World Association of Newspapers clearly isn't as pessimistic as some. But let's start the discussion from there. Philip, where are you on the doom and disaster scenario?
Neither here nor there, really, to be honest. I mean, I clearly the growth of overall newspaper circulation is more a factor of developments in the developing world, with a rising number of middle-class people able to afford newspapers. People always wanted to have a newspaper before couldn't afford one. So we're looking at a still continuing growth in certain sectors of the newspaper business, mostly in the developing world. My negative view more comes from the failure of the business model of the past, an advertising business model which has not adapted well to the internet, and therefore requires that change in that business model rather than change in either the volume or the type of journalism put out. I believe there is still the same roughly speaking, demand for journalism, both of whether it's a very broad coverage of the world or whether it's very specific coverage of a chess match. We have to adapt. We have to find new ways of raising revenue, and I think that means grasping the fact that people will have to pay more directly for their news, for their comment, for their opinion, in whatever area it is, rather than relying on the indirect way of paying through advertising. And we're really seeing that happening with the disappearance of a lot of classified advertising to the web. That's perfectly natural. It doesn't say anything at all about journalism. It just says something about how the existing business model is out of date, and that therefore we need to adapt to it.
Katie Chen, can I ask you perhaps to more directly address this question from the point of view of Chinese language media, which is obviously where you're located?
Well, I think it's sad for journalists, you know, and because you see the newspaper industry is really declining, you know, and there are a lot of milestone events. For example, in the United States, you know, you see a lot of newspaper collapse, and even the New York Times sale of its building for getting capitals, and in Hong Kong also, I think we still have some Chinese newspaper, but the competition is keen, and then most of them, I think, are losing money, and so I think the situation is very difficult, and the problem, I think, for the whole industry is that like the free newspaper in Chinese, and it now become a dominated market, and people are not willing, you know, to pay, you know, for the good news and the quality story. So and also, according to some survey, if they found the people under 18 years old, if they never read newspaper, they won't be frequent, you know, newspaper readers. So we face a different kind of challenges. You know, for example, the reading habit of the younger generation. Will they still buy newspaper and then read the newspaper with a print media, and then the and then the domination of the free newspaper or the free service on the web, and you know, all that kind of challenges. And so for us, I think the Chinese newspaper, I think, is in the same trend of the newspaper industry in the world.
Can I just ask one thing that you said? I mean, is the immediate challenge to you stronger from free newspapers than from the web? Is that what you're saying?
I think both. Because, you know, free newspaper, I think, for us, you know, because the EJ is not a mass newspaper, you know, we are the kind of professional financial daily. We are so better because people are still willing, you know, to pay for getting some of the information, you know, about the market or some of the good commentaries. But for the mass media, I think the competition with the free newspaper are very serious.
Okay, Eric, Eric Wishart,
you're working
a bit, yes. You have certainly for the purpose of this discussion, a very useful perspective, because not only have you worked in a number of locations besides Hong Kong, this is your second time here, but I mean, the very business of AFP is to supply the world's newspapers, and not just newspapers, but other media organizations. I mean, as you go around, do you see a lot of long faces and people saying the situation is completely desperate?
I mean, this is very exciting. I come from the what I call the Jurassic Park era of the media. I was a journalist in 1970 before. Maybe not everybody here, but some people here were born. So I saw it in the hot metal days. I told somebody the other day, what was hot metal in a newspaper? They just lead. I mean, this is... It's a long time ago, black and white TV, two television channels. I mean, I think I just wish I was becoming a journalist now. I think it's very exciting. I'm more on the positive side, basically. Working for a news agency, this what is happening is placed at our strengths, of course, because, I mean, there's just this appetite now for minute-to-minute 24-hour news. So it placed our strengths. Our traditional clients, are, the bulk of our revenues, I would say, still comes from traditional media, meaning mainly newspapers and also radio, television. I would say the bulk of our new revenues come from online operators, so there's a real shift. There's a grey area, of course, because newspapers are moving. They all have online editions now, and the question is, how do they monetize it? They tried the advertising model, and just in the last month now, Rupert Murdoch came out and said we're going to have to start paying for the online editions. So I mean, it's a real revolution. But I don't take the negative point of view. I mean, LP records were replaced by compact discs, being replaced more or less by iPods. I mean, the world moves on, and there's no point of crying over spilt milk. And we see a lot of clients. I mean, some are doing better than others. I mean, the Financial Times is still doing very well. I think there's a real market there for quality journalism. I think maybe the days of people just buying newspapers en masse are maybe finishing. It depends on the culture. India is still a huge market for newspapers. United States is declining, but it's declining for various reasons. And there's also a perfect storm at the moment, this cultural change, plus obviously the international financial crisis. So it's going to take some time to get through it. But I mean, everybody's got to adapt. But I mean, that's the modern times. We have to adapt. We can't get too sentimental about it.
Okay. I wonder if I can just come back to you, Casey, because you're picking up on something that Eric says. I mean, one of the things EJ is trying to do is charge people to look on its website, and you're delivering content through that. I mean, first of all, how much, what kind of percentage of your income is now derived from that, and what sort of potential do you think you have?
For the web?
Yes.
For the web, I can't give you the exact number, but on the web, well, say we, for example, an annual fee is charged for, say, like 500 more. Hong Kong dollars. In average, of course, it's lower than the print media, you know, because we sell that $6 a copy, you know, with 6 days a week. And it's more or less, I mean, cheaper than you buy the print copy, I mean, on the web. But even though we make that a very, I mean, a bold decision, because, you know, most of the Hong Kong's news web is still free. But at the very beginning, we decided to, you know, collect the fees, you know, charge a model. And because, first of all, because we believe that there's no free lunch in the world, you know, and so you should pay for the quality journalism. And it seems that the journalists and also the tycoons have now tried to reflect, you know, such situation, because why they provide a free service, you know, on the web. And like Murdoch would like now to charge, you know, on the web service. And but anyway, because for the EJ, we think a long time of how to run this model, you know, on the web. And I think we basically do a very successful start, you know, of charging on our web.
But presumably it's a very small part of your income at the moment.
I think so. But well, we have more than 10,000 paid subscribers, you know. I think that, even though it's not a big number, but I think it's quite a good result of running a charge news web.
Right, let's look again at the wider question, because, Philip, you seem to be
dangerously optimistic in some ways.
The question is what we're seeing in some ways a democratization of the news dissemination business? I mean, you used to have to be a very rich person before you got into the media business in any substantial way. Now you can be, you know, Joe Blow in the street and start up a blog, and that can mushroom in fantastic ways.
Very few blogs do actually mushroom, and I think, you know, so far we've seen that news read on the internet is basically the sort of mass market news rather than the niche market news. On the other hand, what we are seeing now, just the beginnings of, and I think this is absolutely crucial, and I think very few people have actually cottoned on to what's happening, which is micropayments, whereby you're going to have intermediaries with whom you have an account, you know, you say have a, you know, rather like Skype, you have an account, and every time you click on one page of whatever chosen media product it is, you have to pay some very small amount, you know, 1 cent per page to read something or other. It all adds up. And this is certainly a much easier way of getting news on an irregular basis, at any rate, than subscribing for, you know, for a year, having to put in your Visa card number and so on and so forth. So that's one direction. Another direction, I think, that we may be going to in a slightly longer time frame is that, you know, what is the advantage of a newspaper? It's not the fact that it's written on paper. It's the fact that it gives you random access, which you don't get so readily on a screen. And we are again moving to the possibility of having an electronic newspaper which you can fold up. Okay, it's not paper, and it's electronic, so you have the advantages of electronics, but also the advantages of, say, a broadsheet newspaper. So that's another direction which we're probably going over a slightly longer timescale. Another issue is that these very mass market products, I mean the AFP and so on, selling news to around the world, they don't really cater for local interests. And so there's always going to be a place for local media in a way that there has always been. Has been suffering recently because local media have tended to rely very heavily on classified advertising, and they're going to have to move away from that. But nonetheless, the need for local news, what's happening in your town, your county, your province, is still very much there, and it just needs some shift in the model so that people can, this can be a viable business proposition to meet a need which is very much there. And again, I mean, if you look at niche publishing, a lot of areas haven't suffered at all, in fact. A lot of very specifically oriented magazines in to hobbies and so on, yachting magazines and football magazines and so on, have not suffered at all from what's been happening in the broader media world. So, again, I mean, we mustn't forget these sort of publications and imagine that all the products being produced by the various journalism schools, and I'm sorry to say that I now know more people teaching journalism who are journalists, but that there are there are some areas of journalism, you know, real journalism, not PR, which are still flourishing, and I expect some of the others, including ones with which I've been involved one way or another, to continue to flourish so long as that they can adapt their business models to the changes in the forms of delivery. Because changes in forms of delivery don't necessarily mean that you have a change in the nature of the demand for your product.
I don't know if either of you want to contribute to that. There is another point that, Eric, did you have something?
Yes, I mean, I think the topic is actually journalism, and I mean, one thing we're definitely finding in AFP is the whole nature of journalism is changing. I mean, going back again, when I started out, like a lot of people, I learned shorthand, Pittman's shorthand as well, which even predated T-Line, and you learn the basic journalistic skills, which I think are very much still essential and valid today, and there's no shortcut for that. You need to learn the basics. But, I mean, I know multitasking is a terrible cliche, but, I mean, that is what we're looking at now with young journalists. And we have a lot of interns at AFP, a lot from the Baptist University and the Hong Kong University. And they come in and they're already capable of working in photo, text, and more in video. A lot of them are now video capable. So the nature of the job is changing, but... I mean, this is a bit of a debate because I think as media companies, not so much somebody like AFP, but maybe some newspapers are moving online, they want their journalists to multitask. They want them to be able to write the story, take the photo and do the video as well. And I think it's reaching saturation point for some people. They can't do everything. And but, I mean, that's the whole, as I said, the nature of the young journalists that are coming up, they have to be able to do all these task, which means we really have to, there's a big training issue as well. We have to retrain the our existing staff to be able to adapt to the whole multimedia online world.
Yeah, but while they're making a video, taking some stills and trying to report the story, I'm just wondering what's happening to news gathering in all of that.
Well, this is the problem, and I mean, we have to tell the, you know, maybe people that think it's a good economic model that it's not that practical. I mean, I was talking to Mike Clark, our photographer, this morning, and he said, yeah, you cannot take photographs and do video at the same time. I mean, you can maybe do a feature, but it's you've got to be in a different position. It's a different discipline. So, I mean, I think it's great, but multitasking, but it's a bit of a buzzword. But in practical terms, it could definitely lead to a drop in quality. Sure.
Well, we're on. Oh, sorry.
Well, I mean, multitasking has changed in a sense that, I mean, you know, when Eric was started out, I mean, he needed to learn shorthand. He needed to learn about, you know, hot metal and there was no direct input into computers and so on. There were a whole lot of different multitasks that had to be performed in those days. Now it's changed, and you have to be able to know about video and so on and so forth. But you're right. I mean, you can't do all three things at once very effectively. To meet immediate news demands, yes, you can do it. You can have a picture, you can write a two-paragraph story. That's fine as far as it goes, but we all know that people want more than that, so that then you get into the area of specialization, whether it's in words or it's in pictures, whether it's in video or whether it's in still pictures. Beyond the immediate, where, yes, multitasking or ability to multitask, you may not ever actually have to use it so often, but has to be there nonetheless. In the end, people are going to want more, or at least a lot of people are going to want more, and those are the people who are going to be prepared to pay for it, because there is value in the there is added value in the news, the interpretation of the news, the depth of the news, and so on.
Well, let's go to the question of quality, which could well be a crucial one. I mean, specifically in the Chinese media, you could argue that the advent of the new media, particularly on the Chinese mainland itself, has actually led to an increase in the quality of information that citizens have been able to achieve. Because obviously, on the mainland, there's state-controlled newspapers, but also in Hong Kong, I mean, you've got very many sources of independent journalism which are competing with you directly. What do you have to say about the quality of what's coming out of this, if you like, informal online media?
Yes, I think the readers generate content. I think is very, really, very powerful. You know, say many. In many occasions, you know, that's not relying on a TV crew people, you know, and then the readers, you know, they write the stories and also provide pictures sometimes, you know, or the video for the TV station or for the newspaper. For the quality stories, for example, for us, I think we still can, charge, you know, for the readers. For example, if they want to really have some of the good analysis or the more good ideas, you know, how to invest. I mean, that kind of very niche service and the information or the commentaries, I think still people are willing to pay, but for the mass media, for the mass newspaper or for the mass media, you know, if that's the quote-unquote the general news or general reports, and I think it's just very difficult, you know, to charge, you know, for that part of the stories.
But what about the actual reporting? I mean, you take the Sichuan earthquake as an example. A lot of the information from that earthquake didn't come from the professional media. It came from people just uploading information onto the web, saying, I saw such and such a building collapse. I think there were so many people trapped inside it. I mean, it seems to me it's an enormous problem. You've got all these people out there disseminating information without control, but somehow it often has a higher credibility than the information that goes through sub-editors and all the normal editorial processes.
But in mainland, I think the situation is different, you know, because the government control, you know, quite tightly. So the situation is that on the web, sometimes people's discussion, you know, will dominate, you know, and set the agenda. So then go back to the newspaper, and then the newspaper should follow or should cover that event. So I mean, it's different from Hong Kong, but in Hong Kong also, some of the very important news was also initiated by some of the bloggers or the readers provide materials, and then to kick off the story, and then the newspaper to follow up. You know, that's the logic. You know, but not in the old days that the newspaper set the agenda and then people would discuss. And that's not the situation now.
Eric, are you competing with so-called citizen journalists?
I mean, I think it's complementary. I mean, I think the more people that want to be journalists, citizens, or professional, or whatever, the better for everybody, because it creates a lot of interest in the profession. But at the same time, I think, I mean, people who are interested and who are reading that, I would hope that they would see the value in news reported by the big established news organisations like AFP, AP, Reuters, BBC. I think it has to be complementary. It's not a substitute for, but we use it as a tool as well. I know the twittering was a big issue in the Mumbai attacks. There was a lot of information. I mean, you just can't say it. They're just a bunch of amateurs. They're not credible. You have to ignore it. But at the same time, I mean, there are obvious serious credibility issues with it.
Okay, let's just open this up. It's the usual ground rules apply. If you'd just like to identify yourself and say who you represent, indeed, if you represent anyone. Does anybody wish to kick off here? Tom.
Thanks. Tom Mitchell with the FT, and Eric, thanks for the little plug, the FT. One thing that annoys the chief executive of the Financial Times to no end is that a cup of Starbucks coffee costs more than our newspaper, and we charge $27. And then people will go and buy many cups of coffee, but only one FT. We've actually had some success in raising the price of the product. I'm wondering what KC's experience is in terms of raising the price of the EJ. Is that something that the market simply will not bear? And from the perspective of AFP, are you able to increase the cost of the information you're providing to newspapers, or are your clients just so constrained that's also not an option?
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, for the Chinese newspaper, we charge $6, but this applies for, I mean, more than 15 years. You know, in these years, you can see how much your salaries are increased. You know, how much of the prices in these supermarkets has raised, you know. But we still charge $6, you know. So, it's very difficult, you know. Even though some of the Chinese newspaper want to negotiate and see, well, how we can do something, for example, to charge, say, $8 or $10, or I don't know. But it's very, very difficult, you know. Very, very difficult. And then after we have Chinese newspaper in the town, and I think it's still very difficult, you know, for the newspaper to charge more, you know.
When did you last have a price increase?
$6?
Yeah.
I think maybe 16 years ago. Yeah.
I mean, AFP, basically, for the traditional media, we pay we charge a monthly subscription. It's done on a subscription basis, which tends to vary according to the market circulation of the newspaper, size of the television station. And in normal times we ask for an annual pay increase, but these are not normal times. So we find, the impact of the economic crisis for us, it takes a time to work through, because our clients tend to suffer because of a downturn in advertising, for example. So it's not quite as immediate as that. But we found that towards the end of last year, the start of this year, a lot of clients either asked us to freeze or give them a discount or give them a month free. So at the moment, I think the general market for us is pretty much in a holding pattern. There have been some exceptions, though, around the world. It's, you know, I don't want to go into specifics, but one or two countries, we managed to get our annual... we managed to get the subscription rates up. So, the impact of the crisis, although it's been pretty uniform, there have been patches, some places where the media haven't been too badly affected.
I don't know what situations at AFP, but, I mean, clearly the market is to some extent distorted by other wire services, Bloomberg and Reuters, which generate most of their revenue from the financial sector and are actually subsidizing their general news to absolutely massive extent. So this has a very negative, in my view, impact both on the nature of the news that they're putting out, because half the time they're only quoting their clients. No, they're not quoting, you know, they want to write a story about Indonesian politics. Do they quote some professor of politics at the university in Jakarta? No, they quote Goldman Sachs, for Christ's sake. So those guys know more than the local people who study the matter. I mean, this is a very serious problem. The other is, I think, that all newspapers are devaluing their worth. I mean, if I can criticize the outfit which I write for, the New York Times, the stroke International Herald Tribune, I mean, New York Times gives away its whole service for practically peanuts. Around the world, and then expects the IHT to compete against newspapers which have the same news. I mean, it's bizarre, but there are people in this media business, newspapers in particular, which are more concerned with the extent to which they're read than by having any kind of commercial logic. This is actually rather typical of two of those who buy newspapers, because they think it's a prestigious thing to own rather than having any very clear idea about how to make money out of them. There's also a tendency, again I won't say any specific examples, but of large corporations to acquire small and medium sized publications, and in the process forget that niche publications have very different needs and expectations of their readers than very large ones, and therefore it's very easy for a big company to buy a small one and simply lose track of who its readers are, what they want, and what that niche publication is all about. So I think we have to be thinking fairly fundamentally. Again, it goes back to business models, but also at the distortions which have been introduced, particularly as a result of the power, hopefully now fading, of the investment banking community.
I'm sure Philip wasn't referring to any local publications there. Not. Point over here.
I think my question is going to... LCU, I'm a barrister. I think my question is going to raise a slightly different topic, but I hope it's associated with the general discussion today. And I think the biggest challenge faced by the newspapers industry today is actually not the free competition from the free newspapers or, say, on the web. It's actually the fact that newspaper is now largely being owned by individual, hugely rich businessmen. So my question is directed to KC Chen in this aspect, because as the chairman has commented, your ownership of the papers has changed. My question is two-part. The first one is, I remember reading an article from your newspaper written by, I don't know his English name, but Lin Yuzhang, Mr. Lin. That was before he took his leave, this short leave, I think sometime this month. His thesis of his article is this. He was commenting on PCCW case, and as you know, well, I think, there are very few pieces of commentary articles on the controversy created by the PCCW fiasco lately. And he has one defense, where he commented on something, but he also made a point of view. His thesis is this. He thinks that if a social controversy is created by the owner of a publication, he thinks that the commentator of that particular publication should be refrained from making comments. And his reason is that because he thinks that no matter what they say, not what the commentators of that particular publication say, will not be seen as objective. So that's his thesis. My first part of the question is, do you agree with the thesis? My question number one. My question number two is, I am an avid EJ reader. From what I've recall about reading PCCW Fiasco is there are a total of four pieces of commentaries about PCCW. I think one piece is by Stephen Zhang, one piece is by Zhang Ginghong, the radio previous radio host show, previous legislator member, and one piece by Gong Yiufei, previously Fong Chuyu. And one piece is, I think, by yourself in the editorial. I don't know if it is written by you. But those, that is all. And I think that the three first articles that I've mentioned have favorable review on what Richard Lee had done about the PCCW deal. Okay, I can see that you... But the question is, so I want to ask... I'm trying to refrain myself from making a speech. My question is it a coincidence that all these favorable reviews on the PCCW, is it a coincidence? Or is it some kind of self-censorship on the EJ?
Just before you answer, just in case anyone has been on the moon for the last 3 months, we are talking about the fact that Richard Lee now has a controlling stake in EJ and has been the subject of this controversy over the attempted privatization of PCCW. Just to
so sorry that you are the frequent reader of the HKEJ, because I think we are far more than four articles talking about the PCCW case, and you obviously miss a very important gentleman whose name is Wang Wenping, who is a former SAR senior official who had written about PCCW at least three long articles which criticize Mr. Lee very, very severely. You know, if you missed that article, please tell me and leave your address, your email address, and I'll send to you free of charge. No, that's on the newspaper, you know. Well, frankly, because I'm not quite, I don't want to be very defensible, but several points I want to raise. You know, first of all, no matter who controlled the newspaper, I think the owner should be very aware of the independence, editorial independence of that newspaper, because that's the basic value, the core value, and the basic value of that newspaper. You know, for HKEJ, I think I have talked to our editors and reporters many, many times. I said that please go ahead and cover this news and comment on this. You know, basically, if you base on the fact, and then that your comments is fair, you know. So, I mean, we first of all, we won't give any restrictions or guidelines, you know, for our reporters and our editors, you know, how to do this kind of news, you know. And all the things are based on the new on the facts. And also, at the same time, we have a very, very clear agreement, you know, with our management, that we will keep our editorial independence and run as usual, you know, before Mr. Lee take over. So, I mean, why people have this kind of, I mean, impression, I really don't know, but I just want to give you the more comprehensive picture, and thank for your giving me a chance, you know, to explain, you know, our situation in this case. We, frankly, I told you, we handle this very, very carefully, you know, because we clearly we understand that people will see how EJ covered this news, you know, because, you know, as you mentioned, that's the new boss and the real conflict of interest and that kind of things. But basically, I think we do it very well, you know, because I'm not saying the good words, you know, for our newspaper, but frankly, you know, we're doing a very good work. So when you read the news, we basically cover very comprehensively, you know, what's going on in the court and the different views, you know, from different people, you know, about the PCCW's case. And about the commentary, and again, I just want to remind you, we pr- print more and more than these four pieces, you know, articles. And most of them are very, very critical, you know, to Mr. Lee's handling of the case, or even whether it's fair or not of this privatization offer, you know. But because I think it's fair, you know, because in Hong Kong, you know, there's not only one newspaper, you know, there are a lot of newspaper and different channels that people can express their views. If we are so biased and so, I mean, protected to our boss, I think it would not be acceptable, you know, by our readers. So I understand your thinking and your impression. And also we have read a lot of discussions on our web, you know, even though some of our readers criticize a lot. But, I mean, we try to explain our situation and we try to do it, you know, as fair as we can. And basically, I think we can maintain, you know, that balance. And what I can say again is that we really keep our independence during the whole process, you know. So, well, that's the case, you know. So, but I mean, it's very a real challenge, you know, for us to how to handle this. Sorry.
Okay. Philip, did you want to make a wider point about ownership?
Well, yes, I did. I mean, I don't want to get involved in PCCW and the Economic Journal. But surely, at least in the Hong Kong case, I mean, there's a fair degree of pluralism in the printed media, although obviously there are dangers of the use by large business people, not of ownership of the media so much as the use of advertising pressures and so on. But I think journalists in Hong Kong and indeed many other countries need to be far more concerned of what happens in the in television and electronic media generally, where the pressures are greater because you have greater government controls. So they may not be direct, but they are licensing issues and so on. You have advertising pressure is that much greater because advertisers often don't want to be involved with programs which are controversial. So I think, I mean, if one looks at TV in Hong Kong, I mean, it's some of the news programming is in my view absolutely appalling, and it is quite clearly driven by the political interests of the people who own the station. And I wouldn't apply that to the same degree to the printed media. So I think, you know, we're talking about journalism in general, and I think, you know, journalists need to be more worried about what's happening in the electronic media, television in particular.
Okay, is there another point here that anybody would like to raise? We have, please.
Jane Lau, CLP. My question is a general, very, very general one. Does Hong Kong still have the attractiveness to keep international media, the foreign correspondents, the bureaus in Hong Kong, while everybody seems to have set up their own offices and bureaus over in Beijing and Shanghai and everywhere in China?
Well, Eric, you have your regional headquarters here.
Yes,
perhaps you have a view on that.
That's a question I can answer. I mean, we've been in Hong Kong a long, long time, and Hong Kong's our Asia. We're divided into four or five regions, headquarters in Paris, and our Asia-Pacific headquarters is Hong Kong, which basically means it's the editing hub, editing commercial technical hub for from Kabul, India, South Asia, Japan, China, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand. So it's a big sweep. And I mean, I was here, last time I was here was just before the handover, and there was a bit of debate generally. I mean, not just the news agencies, do we stay, do we go? And we stayed in Hong Kong, and for us it's a fantastic location from a purely practical point of view, from a travel point of view, but we have to get places quite fast. I mean, Hong Kong's it's great. From editorial freedom point of view, we've never had any pressure or any problem whatsoever in Hong Kong, and the whole technical infrastructure is first class. So we've stayed here. I mean, there were more. I was just talking, I think, to Steve or Jake before we were having lunch. There are fewer journalists or correspondent members here now than there were 10 years ago. So perhaps newspapers or other media have moved out, gone elsewhere, gone to Beijing. maybe Hong Kong, from that point of view, isn't the journalistic centre it was, or in the heydays of the Vietnam War when Hugh Van Ness was taking photographs. But from an international news agency point of view, and we're one of the big three, Hong Kong is a perfect location. It's kind of expensive, though.
Okay. Can I?
I was going to just ask a final point, but let me ask that anyway. Do you want?
Well, yeah, I do, because I mean, from a freedom point of view, freedom of media access and so on, Hong Kong cannot be bettered. And it distresses me to see organizations, which I include the BBC, Reuters, basing regional operations in Singapore, knowing perfectly well they cannot report freely about Singapore, and yet they use that as their main news center for Asia. And I think that's absolutely disgraceful, and I hope that, please put that as a matter of public record.
Okay, let me just wind things up by very briefly asking all the participants this question. We're at the 60th anniversary of the FCC. Do you think in 60 years we'll be having a discussion about newspapers, i.e. will they be significant enough to be worth discussing? Can I start with you, Casey?
Yeah, sure, I think so. And I think the debate will be still going on, yeah. Because I think the journalists are now is in the crossroad, you know, and how to develop and how to exist, you know, how to struggle for the survive, you know. I think the debate will going on. Yeah.
It's a good question. 60 years. I hope we do. I mean, I think newspapers, I mean, despite the digital age, I mean, they still provide a fantastic, I mean, they fill a need. And I hope in 60 years' time we'll still be talking about them, yes.
They probably won't be made of paper, but they will exist.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. I have to somehow scuttle over there and give you one of the FCC's priceless gifts, but before I do that, perhaps we could thank all our participants in the normal way. Thank you very much indeed.
I wondered, I think you mentioned real journalism, not PR, and I think I mean, I think here. Yeah. So the problem isn't with PR. The problem is with journalists who simply don't have time to, you know, to do anything more than take the PR handout and run them. Yeah, they got to get on. They got to get the story out. You know, they can't. They can't, you know, sort of go back and check the facts or look into the background. Or, you know,
it's a greater burden on the PR people too,
you know,
because if you get something wrong,
then... Well, yeah, it's not really, you know, I think from the point of view of journalists, I mean, it, yeah, there's always a story behind the PR release, right? Yeah.
I don't have a
problem. No, they provide it.
Thank you.